This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 202 was recorded on January 16th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Grant Williams, editor and publisher of the Things That Make You Go, newsletter, joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss civil unrest around the globe, what's causing it, what it means, and where it's all headed. We'll also discuss failed unicorn stocks like WeWork and not yet failed unicorn stocks like Tesla. And, of course, it wouldn't be Grant Williams without coverage of gold and where precious metals are headed. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will take a deep dive into the gold collar options strategy, which we discussed briefly last week.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 hasn't let up. We're above 3,300 here. What's your take on what's going on in the S&P?
Well, Patrick, lots of people have theories for why the market should be topping here. Saxo Bank had a note out saying this could be it. A lot of people have been saying, okay, once we get the trade deal, it's going to be a sell the news story. Because after the trade deal's done, what's the next thing for the market to look forward to? Well, needless to say, those theories haven't panned out, at least as of this afternoon. We're right on new all-time highs yet again, above 3,300. Now, I think, again, that this is all being driven by expectations about central bank liquidity, so I don't really put a lot of faith into all of those theories. I think that what we're going to see here is more of the same, what we've seen, which is the market continues to melt up. I know that you've got a whole bunch of work that you've been doing in terms of charts and technical levels and so forth. Let's save that for the post-game segment where we can really take some time and dive into it.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index, which is more or less muddling just above the 97 level. Do you think there's a turn point coming here in the dollar?
You know, we're still in the same story we talked about last week. What I feared was that we were seeing that rally that I thought looked like it might be starting to roll over. Sure enough, it has begun to roll over, and it looks like it's continuing to trend down inside a new downsloping channel. Only a daily close over 97.50 on the March contract would negate that. Doesn't look like that's going to happen. The next big confirmation for the bears would be a daily close below 96 on the March contract. We're still well above that now, but let's see what happens in the next week or two.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, which is bouncing after being below $58 for a little bit here. What's your take on the crude oil markets here?
Well, first of all, Patrick, the big sell-off didn't surprise me at all. In fact, our regular listeners will recall that I predicted exactly that outcome if and only if there was a de-escalation of the situation with Iran. And that's what we've seen so far. Now, I don't think the Iran situation is necessarily over yet, but for the moment, we're on Iran geopolitical risk off. So I think that if you look at where the major technical levels are on WTI, they're at 58, 55, and 51, roughly. We hit 58, actually. The technical level was just below that, 57.82. We closed just about on it yesterday. And you knew that that had to be good, at least for a bounce. And that's what we're seeing today, is a bounce. Is it just going to be a bounce? And if so, how high does it bounce? Or is it a reversal of direction? I think that's going to depend entirely on whether or not there's any more geopolitical re-escalation. Assuming that Iran stays de-escalated and that we don't have any big geopolitical news hit the tape, I think this bounce could take us. The obvious targets would be the 8-day moving average at 59 spot 18 or the 13-day moving average at 60 spot 29. Those will both be coming down tomorrow. So if we just get back up to the high that we had today, that will probably be the 8-day moving average as of tomorrow. So it may be that the top of the bounce is already in. Frankly, I doubt it. Oftentimes, Friday is an up day. So let's say we get back to $60 tomorrow. That might end the bounce, and I think that's probably as far as it goes if there's no new impetus to move higher. On the other hand, if we have an Iran re-escalation, we could go back to $65, and we could easily get to $75 if there were American casualties in any kind of attack. So it's really a moving target. But if we don't see more of that escalation occurring, then I think that this bounce plays out, and we probably go back and eventually test $55.
How did the inventory numbers come in there, Eric?
Crude oil drew down a little bit bigger than analysts' expectations, 2.6 million barrel drawdown. Analysts were expecting about a million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, though, building 342,000 barrels. That's very significant in my mind. First of all, it's opposite direction of the national drawdown. But more importantly, we saw a long trend of Cushing drawdowns, including some big ones after the Keystone Pipeline spill. It looks like we're finally recovering from that. And Cushing inventory had been getting kind of critically low there. So we're seeing a turnaround there. The really big news, though, same story as last week, actually, was despite the drawdown in crude oil, there were just massive, massive builds in finished products. Gasoline building 6.7 million barrels. That's a huge build, but it's not as big as the distillates build of 8.2 million barrels. So once again, the finished product builds more than outweigh the crude oil drawdown. U.S. production, meanwhile, ticked up to a new all-time record of 13 million barrels. And that's quite significant because we still haven't seen a turnaround in the rig count or the frac spread yet, but we're still seeing production increasing. So it's going to be very interesting to continue to watch that. Imports, 6.6 million barrels. Exports, 3.5 million barrels. Tape action, of course, was down after inventory continued to fade lower through the rest of the day on Wednesday, but that did take us down to really several key technical levels. We had the continuation chart 200-day moving average at 57 spot 82, which I mentioned before. That also happened to coincide with a channel support trend line that's been in place since October or so. And I think that for a number of technical reasons, we're seeing this bounce. The question is, bounce how high, and do we eventually take out that 200-day moving average on the continuation chart, 57.82? We didn't get quite down to the contract chart 200-day at 57.19. That will be the next major support level that we'll be watching.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, which has more or less been backfilling that big breakout on the upside. Is your thinking still here that this is just a pullback to buy on dip?
I think so, Patrick. You know, we clearly have seen a blow-off top. Well, of course we did. We had, first of all, a whole bunch of momentum carrying the market higher, and then the Iran escalation. Everybody freaked out. We got up to some really high numbers, over $1,600. We've seen this pullback. Already, what it looks like is forming is a bull flag pattern. So you see that chop up and down for the last week or so. We'll probably see some more of that up and down. And what you want to watch for is when it breaks that downsloping line to the upside, that would be the signal that the bull flag formation is over and that we're going to continue to move higher. Now, of course, we could break down and move lower. The biggest argument for a big move lower is the commitment of traders report suggests that really the gold market is overweight with a lot of speculative long interest. I don't think you're going to see a collapse to the downside unless there's some kind of big macro driver to push it. So for the moment, I think probably we're going to see this flag pattern continue to play out by the dips and watch for a break above that trend line that's being formed now through the highs, which occurred on the 10th of January and then again yesterday on the 15th of January. That's where you want to draw the trend line, and I expect that we probably see a couple of more up and downs eventually. If it plays out as most bull flag patterns do, we'll break that to the upside and probably see an acceleration to the upside from there. And as I've stressed many times before, Patrick, I do still think that there is scope for a significant downside correction. Don't buy so much gold that you're going to panic if we get back down to $1,400. But the more that I look at this chart, I just don't see it happening right now.
All right, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yields, which are hovering around the 1.80 level. What's your thinking here on Treasuries?
You know, I really don't have a lot to add since last week. I think we're range-bound. I don't really have a strong opinion. If I had to guess, I'd say we're probably going to resolve this range to the downside. It seems like that's where the trend is, but it's not a strong trend. What levels are you watching, and how do you see the Treasury market?
Well, Eric, I continue to be a bond bull in this situation. I mean, we had a situation where the bond yields were basically halved through 2019, going from 3% down to like 1.5%. And it was overdue for a reaction the other way. There was no shortage of bond bears out there trying to call that was it, especially because of the bund yields reversing. But I'll tell you, for all this reflation impulse stuff that everyone's been talking about and higher commodity prices, the yield has not even attempted a legitimate breakout above 2%. We're going on 4+ months of just sideways chop. I mean, if this is the best that the bond bears can do, you know what? They've got nothing. I think any legitimate breakdown below 170 on the yield could send bonds on another journey to the down, or at least the bond yields down to its September lows again.
Well, Patrick, I agree with you. One place where I do have strong conviction in this bond market is I don't think the people who think we're going back to 5 or 6% Treasury yields are right. And the reason that I say that, Patrick, Ray Dalio couldn't have made the case better when he just said, look, they don't have to let that happen. Why would the government allow Treasury yields to run away to the point where they can't afford to pay their own bills when they have the ability to suppress them? They're going to continue to suppress them before they're going to put the U.S. government into a fiscal crisis where it's unable to roll its own debt. So I don't see Treasury yields going back above 3.5 anytime in the foreseeable future. As far as whether they really go down from here and maybe hit new all-time lows below that 1.34 set back in 2016, that would be my leaning, but I just don't have a whole lot of conviction about it.
Well, you know, I'll just add to that the fact that even just a normal retracement of the prior move should have seen yields going to 2.25 just on a normal reaction. The fact that we haven't been able to be 2% is showing that the bond bears have got nothing. At least they haven't had anything up to date. And so right now, I think that looking for a breakdown in yields is still the path of least resistance. Anyway, so this week's featured interview guest is Grant Williams. So why did we invite Grant back on the show this week?
Well, Patrick, Grant has been teaching me to pronounce his name like a British gentleman, so I'm supposed to not say Grant. In any event, Grant has been a visionary guy in the sense that he has had the picture on gold and negative yielding debt and a lot of the really big stories in the macro economy right for a long time. In terms of his track record, he's got a habit of being early. He's made a lot of calls a little bit before their time, but he's been proven right in the end. And certainly that's what we're seeing now with gold. He was very, very strong conviction, bullish gold when we talked to him a year ago, whereas I was not and a lot of our other guests were not. So he's a very, very smart guy. He's also speaking along with you at VRIC this weekend in Vancouver. So we wanted to get some exposure for Grant. And of course, we had Marin Katusa on the show last week. I should mention, incidentally, that we're still getting emails from people who are telling us that we didn't tell you how to claim the 42% discount on Marin Katusa's newsletter. We really did tell you, folks. It's linked in your research roundup email, which tells me the people who are not getting it are not getting a research roundup email, probably because they're afraid to give us their email addresses. There's really nothing to fear, people. We won't spam you. We won't sell your email address. But if you are irrationally research roundup intolerant, you can find that offer at macrovoices.com/Catoosa or CatoosaResearch.com/macrovoices. Either one will work. They have warned us, though, that they will be rigidly enforcing the deadline of Saturday night. That's this coming Saturday, January 18th, and that's midnight Pacific time. The reason that they have to enforce that is starting on the 19th at the VRIC show, they have to be back up to full price, in fairness to the people whom they'll be charging full price at the show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In the past, the founder and host, Niels Kastrup Larsen, has provided Macro Voices listeners with some really good resources. But I think you'll agree with me that this time, he's really outdone himself with a brand new third edition to his Ultimate Guide to Systematic Trading Books. Now, this latest edition isn't limited to just quant trading books. It's actually a comprehensive guide to many of the best investing books ever written. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can get a free copy of this excellent guide to all the best investing books by going to toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your research roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
And Eric, just an additional note, those of our listeners that do want to attend the VRIC out in Vancouver this weekend, it is free admission for our Macro Voice listeners by using the promo code MACRO100. And if you do come out there, make sure you say hi to me. Eric's interview with Grant Williams is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here on macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Grant Williams, the editor and publisher of Things That Make You Go, Hmm, perhaps one of the best regarded newsletters in the entire industry. Grant, something that has got my attention and I know has yours, and it has the attention of, I think, the smartest people in the investment industry, is not really just about investments. It's about using our skills as investors to recognize there's things going on in the world that are a really big deal, and they have investment implications for sure, but the social implications, I think, are more important. Give us a quick outline for those people who don't read your newsletter. What's on your mind with respect to civil unrest and the social fabric degradation that's going on around the world?
Hey, Eric. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. And second of all, thanks for the pronunciation of my name, which is always a treat to hear you say it.
I work at it.
I know you do. I know you put a lot of work into that. Look, I kind of pay attention to a lot of stuff going on, and a lot of that stuff is kind of off the beaten path and maybe not in the mainstream media reporting. And I just finished writing a piece called The Year of Living Dangerously. Funnily enough, I literally was just about to put the finishing touches on it, and I received an email from John Malden with his latest letter, which is called, I think, The Decade of Living Dangerously. So this is clearly something that's on people's minds, which I found fascinating. John, if you're listening, I didn't steal your title, I promise. And, you know, what I've been paying attention to, I was asked on a recent interview what I was most bearish about going into 2020. And my answer was the social fabric of the world. And we wanted to talk about some of the problems that we've seen around the world. And so I just finished writing a piece about it. And I began the piece talking about the Gilets Jaunes protest in France, you know, which really you won't see in the media now unless you're looking for it. It was a big deal 18, 19 months ago. You know, thousands of French people out in the streets with these iconic yellow vests on protesting quite violently, as these things tend to be in France sometimes when tempers get high. But it hasn't really been on the front page as much. You'll read little bits about it here and there. Hong Kong kind of took over from that as the sort of unrest du jour. But the Gilets Jaunes protest is still going on, you know, so we're 19 months into it. And the trigger for this was an increase in duty on gasoline prices and diesel prices. And back in May of 2018, a 31-year-old French woman put a petition online. That's all it was, complaining about the high cost of petrol and diesel fuel. And it met with complete, you know, nobody cared about it. 5 months later, another guy saw this petition, took up the cause, and, you know, the rest is history. This guy was a lot more energized, a lot more activist. And, you know, we've had thousands of French people out in the streets every weekend for well over a year now. Now, these taxes were quote-unquote green taxes that Emmanuel Macron proposed, trying to encourage French citizens to seek more eco-friendly alternatives. But we had a situation where diesel prices jumped above gasoline prices for just about the first time in history. It was only briefly, but, you know, there are 80% of the vehicles in France are powered by diesel. And this caused complete outrage. And what was interesting was just how quickly this protest about fuel developed into, you know, a real working class movement, as they called it, a unifying thread and a call to arms. But of course, this protest about petrol moved into problems with the pension system, problems with the wealth divide. It really caught fire very, very quickly. The rich versus poor, the city dwellers versus the country dwellers, and the whole of France kind of rose up in this protest. And the point I was trying to make was this Gilets Jaunes thing, it's not French. This is a global problem. This is something that's happened around the world. You know, just over this last year, we've seen countries like Haiti, Bolivia, Colombia, Venezuela, Chile, which is, you know, one of the most stable South American countries for decades now, Sudan, Algeria, Egypt, all these countries have had massive social disorder, most of it triggered by either rises in food or fuel prices, or the end of subsidies to fuel, generally speaking. But the speed with which they've gone up, the speed with which these fires have been lit, tells you this is something deep-seated, and they're all just looking for a trigger. So, you know, I haven't even talked about Hong Kong, obviously, or Catalonia, or anywhere in the Middle East. You know, Iran, Iraq, we've seen hundreds killed in demonstrations in both those places. And obviously, with recent events, things aren't quieting down anytime soon. So this is a real problem, and it's something that is global in nature. It's something that, as I said, really threatens the very social fabric. And again, you know, we come back to the fact that all these events, ultimately, that the set of dots you have to join to get to them from policymakers is very, very short indeed, whether it's monetary or fiscal policy. That's how all these things start. And with central banks running out of bullets and really being forced to rethink what they're doing, in terms of trying to defray some of this angst, it feels as though the end of the road in terms of people just being quietened down by being told how well the economy's doing. You know, our friend Mr. Trump has been doing a great job of tweeting up a storm, saying how great the economy's doing. When, you know, if you read the smaller sections of the newspapers, you'll find out how few people in America have $400 in their bank account to pay for an emergency. So I think this is a big deal. I think it's going to be a big deal going forward. And I just think it's something people should be paying attention to.
Well, I couldn't agree more, Grant. And, you know, I've tried, Grant.
No, you do it better than anybody, Eric.
I don't know about that. When I moved to Hong Kong in 2009, I was really struck by what an incredibly civilized, nonviolent place it is, one of the safest cities in the world. When the Occupy Central protests started, and I think it was 2010 or 11, you know, the actual protesters were holding up signs apologizing for disrupting the flow of business in the central business district of Hong Kong because they knew it was a nuisance and they're that respectful of a people. They're like, we're really sorry. We kind of like we're the young generation. We are about to have democracy taken away from us by People's Republic of China. It's really important to us, but please excuse us for screwing up the traffic on your sidewalk. We don't mean to be a pest. That's how respectful people are. So when all of the protests turned violent in Hong Kong, and then, you know, and I saw that go down, and then I saw a piece about the violence in Chile. And the situation in Chile, it was they were upset about, among other things, less than a nickel increase in the cost of subway fares, 4 cents. But what started happening was they burned down all of the subway stations, the metro stations in Santiago. And there were people, older Chileans, that were involved during the Pinochet, you know, dictatorship years, saying, this doesn't make sense. You know, the metro is for us. Burning down the rich people's house, you know, that's probably not a good thing to do, but it's understandable. Burning down the subway station, it doesn't make sense. So I started to research this, and I learned there are people who travel around the world. There are the one group is a group of white supremacists from Ukraine who actually travel to places like Hong Kong teaching classes saying, look, don't throw rocks through windows. That's not effective. Burn buildings down instead. It does much more damage. They're actually teaching protesters the tactics, like combat training, of how to do the most damage. And all of a sudden, it makes me wonder what the heck is going on that's driving the violent aspect of this. I certainly understand why wealth inequality has caused so many people to be very, as far as I'm concerned, very justifiably upset. But it almost feels like this direction toward a violent response rather than what might be a more effective response is being orchestrated, like somebody is pulling the strings or running the puppets behind the scenes. Am I crazy to think that?
Well, I mean, I haven't done that kind of research into this. I mean, it's interesting to hear it, and I'll certainly try and find some more about it. But yeah, I think, look, Chile is a perfect example, right? It's a very politically stable country for many, many years. As you said, they raised public transportation costs in rush hour only, I might add, by 4 cents. And the outrage began with the student community who, you know, were angry about this. But the response from the Minister of the Economy, a guy called Juan Andres Fontaine, basically said, you know what, anyone who's upset with this could wake up earlier and pay a lower rate. You know, talk about being tone deaf. And it was that actually that response that kind of triggered an escalation in the anger and the ramifications of it. But I think the fact that these protests seem to get violent so quickly, you know, you've just mentioned a possible reason for it. I don't know whether that's true or not, but what I do know is the fact that I think none of these protests are really about the thing that causes the fire to be lit. You know, this is the problem. The fact that they escalate so quickly tells you that there is a deep-seated dissatisfaction beneath the surface. Some of it, I suspect, is wealth inequality, you know, whether it's jealousy or a sense of unfairness. A big part of it is the cost of living going up, despite people being, as I said, told how great everything's doing, that they have to balance a checkbook every week, and they know that that isn't the case. But there's something about being told by the leaders of your country that everything's fine. People tend historically to believe that. I think that belief is starting to fray because I think we've seen so many examples of leaders, you know, saying everything's fine when it really isn't. And so people are starting to believe that for a less amount of time now. And they're starting to question the media. They're starting to question what their leaders are telling them because instinctively they feel that they're being lied to. And when you're being lied to about many things, it's you can shrug it off. But when you're being lied to and at the same time you can't actually put food on your family's tables, then things tend to escalate very quickly. Throw into the fact that, you know, part of this rich-poor divide, people see politicians who are, you know, incredibly wealthy when they leave office. The amount of corruption around the world in that list of countries I gave you is, again, a ubiquitous trait of all these uprisings. We have this kind of perfect storm of rising costs of necessities, rising cost of assets, which only really benefits the rich, poor leadership, lies, the media being discredited. You know, we have this perfect storm that really taps into, as you said, this anger that people have in terms of wanting to burn the thing down. And whether that's literal or metaphorical, I would say the metaphorical aspect of it is probably far more dangerous.
Grant, I think perfect storm is a perfect metaphor for what's going on here. And, you know, something I've been saying for more than a decade, and this originally came from an economic and investment perspective, you know, what I think about markets, is I've said, look, I don't know how long this charade goes on with central bank, you know, easy money policy, but I know the end game is you can keep getting away with this until you have runaway inflation. And that's what eventually forces the Fed's hand, forces the the central bankers' hands, when they're unable to solve problems just by conjuring more money out of thin air because the act of doing so would exacerbate the problem. That becomes true when your problem is runaway inflation. So I've always said the end game financially for the economy happens when we get someday to a situation of 1970s style runaway inflation. And what I've realized in the last year or so is, wait a minute, the economic and market implications of runaway inflation are going to be the least of our worries. If you think about it, they can solve a problem like the perception. And what they're doing right now is they, in Chile, for example, they have rolled back the subway fare increases. They are working to change the constitution to basically subsidize healthcare and to provide more services and more essentially helicopter money into the economy in order to calm the masses and get this mindset of rebellion to slow down. Well, they can only do that on as long as they don't have an inflation problem. And the central bank won't be able to solve the problem when they do have an inflation problem. So it seems to me that it's not only the financial market, but the global geopolitical and civil unrest situation. I mean, to me, inflation is the big key, and I don't hear anybody else talking about this. Does that mean that I'm misinterpreting this and my idea that inflation is the key is wrong? Or is it just that nobody's thinking about it yet?
No, I don't think you're wrong at all. But I think what's happened is inflation as a potential problem has been dead for so long now that people have, as we always do, people have made the assumption that it'll never be a problem again, certainly not in the West. You know, we've looked at growth, and certainly they have poor demographics helping them in terms of costs falling in the West and many places in the East. So I think the central banks have been blessed in that they've been able to do this longer than they would have done before simply because of the demographic picture, which I know you've spoken about a lot on the show. But yeah, look, inflation is really always the trigger for a lot of this stuff. It was in the 70s. It periodically has been in Asia over the last 20, 30 years when prices of basic staple foods have gone up too fast and too far. It's always caused problems. But really what we have here, Erica, as you kind of alluded to there, is a bunch of problems created by central banks who have, in trying to stem the blood from the last trauma, have set themselves up for failure. Because I think you're right, the one thing they can't solve is what you just described. And yet all their policies are ultimately taking us down that road. You know, it's basically a fait accompli at this stage. It's just a question of when. I think they were hoping that the first inflation they would see would be the good kind, the benign 2% kind that would help them with this debt burden. That hasn't happened. And in trying to pour more gasoline on that fire and get that boiler just stoked a little bit, they have put all the aspects in place for a real inflationary problem. And as much as people will tell you that inflation is not a problem, the bond market's going to go higher, deflation is still going to be a problem, they may be right. They may be right, and I can see how that might be the short-term problem. But if you look around the world, you can see that every one of these central banks is desperately trying to create inflation. And ultimately, they will be successful at some point. And my worry is they won't be successful in the right way. They'll throw so much at this that they quickly create the kind of inflation that is really dangerous. And I think what we're seeing happen in the world is an early signal that that's where we're headed. The headline numbers don't show it, but the reaction from people certainly does. You know, if you look at Venezuela, right, here's a country which has been in chaos for a long time. And next month, we are approaching the 30th anniversary of something called the Caracazo, which was, again, social unrest triggered by an IMF deal that announced they'd have to hike the cost of public transportation, fuel, and utilities. This was, say, 30 years ago next week. This led to massive social unrest, which ultimately led to both Hugo Chavez and later Victor Maduro. We're coming up on the 30th anniversary with that. And again, we're seeing problems in Venezuela where they're talking about potential removal of subsidies. Now, in Venezuela, if you're, I think it's 15 years or over, you can apply for what's called, wonderfully, a fatherland ID card. And this basically is means tested. You answer some questions about what you can and can't afford, and it gives you state subsidies. If you have one of those cards, you pay one bolivar for a liter of gasoline. Now, on the black market, that same liter of gasoline will cost 4 million bolivars. So, I mean, to put it in perspective, that one US dollar will fill the average car's gas tank twice a day, every day for a year. And of course, across the border in Colombia, people paying 75 cents a litre for gasoline. So people are making ends meet by, you know, looting the government oil reserves, taking across the border, selling it at a massively inflated price, and to put food on the table. And so that's how precarious these places are. And so when you look at this happening in Venezuela, you look at the dire state of the economy, and you see them potentially talking about taking away the only way many people can afford to put food on the table a month ahead of the 30th anniversary of the biggest social unrest in the country's history, which, I mean, 300 people officially died, but unofficial estimates said that it was way more than 2,000. You have all the pieces in place here for yet more unrest. And I think our problem in the West is we listen to unrest in these far-off places, assume it's not a problem that we'll ever have to deal with, and assume we can just ignore it. And in many cases, the actual unrest won't affect you. If there's a food protest in Sudan, the best one was the Lebanon, where the prime minister put a tax on WhatsApp messages, and that was the spark that ignited the fuel over there. You can ignore some of these things, and some of them are kind of interesting little stories, but once you put all this together anecdotally, there is a real problem developing here in the, as I said, in the social fabric. And talking about these things is inflammatory in itself, and people kind of struggle to think about these concepts without it sounding, alarmist. But the evidence is there. It's on every newspaper that we've read for the last several years. It's all there if you dig deep enough. The fact that the Gilets Jaunes protests have fallen away from the front pages is interesting to me. It very much looks like they're very deliberately trying not to talk about this in the hope that if people don't know it's happening, they won't pay attention. But that protest has now morphed into a massive protest in France about pension reform. Again, people are being told that the promises that were made to them are unaffordable now, and they may have to think about either working longer or paying in more or receiving less. And this is a rolling crisis that is really not just rolling through society in various countries, but it's rolling around the world.
And to be clear, I don't predict inflation starts right away either.
Right.
But I think the question that we agree is so important is, okay, if we know that inflation is the problem that they can't solve, then what would bring it about? And as our regular listeners know, I've got one version of that, but I really want to hear yours. My version is, I think what happens next is politicians realize, hey, they've been conjuring trillions of dollars out of thin air and using it to buy bonds in the open market. We can do the same thing, and we can use it to fund all of our social spending problems, whether it's universal basic income, Medicare for everybody, forgiveness of tuition, free tuition, forgiveness of student loans. We can do all of it, and we don't have to tax anybody. And that will, what I fear the most is, I think it will be fabulously successful, Grant, in the beginning. It'll feel great. They'll declare victory because the inflationary effect of that won't be felt until a couple of years later, at which point it'll be too late. And that's where we really get to the end game. That's me and my story. Tell me your vision, or perhaps several different visions, of how things might evolve to where we eventually see this perfect storm that you've described come to a head.
Well, look, what you've just described is exactly my fear too, Eric. I mean, I can see them hanging the mission accomplished banners up in front of the Fed already. I think that's exactly what will happen. You can see it if you're paying attention. It's happening in slow motion right in front of our eyes. You just have to look at the policies of the Sanders and the Warrens of the world, the casting billionaires in a bad light. We're going after this stuff. We can pay for all this. It's all being set up right now. And I suspect the thin end of the wedge is probably going to be student debt. They'll do something about that because it taps into every demographic, particularly the most energized demographic, which is the youth for them. And I think you're absolutely right. If they go down the MMT, UBI route, it will be successful initially. And that terrifies me. I suspect it won't be a couple of years because of the kind of groundwork that's been laid previously in stoking this inflationary fire. I think had they just come out of the blue and done that, maybe they've bought themselves a little bit longer, but I think their solutions are getting more and more drastic because the problem is getting bigger and bigger. And that tells me that the eventual response to it when it feeds its way through the system will necessarily be bigger too. And I really do share your fears. And I really think that is where we're headed.
Grant, I want to move on now to another topic that you, I should credit you first. You really nailed it. I can't remember. It was about a month ago, 2 months ago, before WeWork fell all apart. You, either on this program or somewhere else, I don't even remember where I heard you saying it. You're saying, look, it's really time for some of these Silicon Valley unicorns to fall apart. And you mentioned WeWork, and I think it was just a week or two before WeWork all, you know, just completely collapsed as people realized that really there's nothing new there. It's the age-old model of an office suites, and there's nothing special about it. And it's not worth billions and billions of dollars. At the same time, though, you mentioned Tesla, and I couldn't agree with you more that, at least as far as reality is concerned, Tesla was overvalued, but it's gotten considerably more overvalued since. So congratulations on WeWork. When do you get proven right on Tesla?
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. It really is. I think let's get to Tesla in a minute. I think the WeWork thing is important, and the point I've been making about that, again, is really goes beyond the company itself. What amazed me about Tesla, and I've been writing about WeWork on and off for a couple of years now, talking about this. And what really caught my eye was the fact that what took WeWork finally down, and don't forget, this thing was days away from a $90 billion IPO. 3 weeks later, it was basically being bailed out and was essentially bankrupt. What took it down was nothing more than a shift in narrative, perception, whatever you want to call it. You know, they fired their S1, which was filled with all the kind of stuff that we've been reading and writing about WeWork for years, but which was held up as how it was innovative and it was going to change the world. And, you know, Adam Newman was a genius and Masason was this crazy visionary and everything was great. They filed the S1, and for whatever reason, people just couldn't stomach the nonsense anymore. They just couldn't ignore it. They couldn't continue to pretend it wasn't ridiculous. And so all we had was a shift in narrative. And, you know, WeWork's collapse was spectacular. But what's been more interesting for me in the follow-up is the collapse in the perception of Masayoshi Son, who was, you know, a hero to millions. He was the unicorn maker, the king maker, whatever you want to call him. And, you know, if you can find me in the last 6 weeks a piece about him or the software vision, the SoftBank Vision Fund that doesn't cast him as a fool with too much money just spraying it around investing in ridiculous ideas, then please send it to me, because I've been paying really close attention to this, and everybody is now piling on to Masason, you know, then visionary, now buffoon. And that just tells me how fragile this whole unicorn, celebrity, CEO, investor space is. You know, which brings us perfectly to Tesla, because, you know, I think this is exactly the same thing going on. What's happened is people have got into a war over Tesla, and it's a war being conducted between bulls and bears, and it really has galvanized around the share price. You know, the share price has been the arbiter of who's right and who's wrong at most points through this particular discussion. And, you know, to me, that's complete nonsense. I just don't think that's the way to think about this, because at any point in the last 3 years, the bulls have been right plenty of times, the bears have been right plenty of times. The stock price shouldn't be the arbiter of who's right and who's wrong. Ultimately, it's the success and failure of the company. And what I've been struck by is the kind of mindset of both sides of the camp. And I really do try and be circumspect about this thing. I'm not a fan of Elon Musk. I'm on the record as saying I think this thing is a fraud. I think the equity value is zero. And I've seen nothing that makes me believe anything different. In fact, I've had those fears reinforced multiple times with some of the things that have been said and some of the, you know, lawsuits you read about. But look, the bears, like me, have been wrong in terms of stock price for the last 3 months. What the stock's done has been extraordinary in that time. I don't think that's changed any of the fundamental reasons why many of the bears are critical of the company, of the CEO. I think all those reasons are well-founded. I think they're all still in effect. And I think ultimately they will be too much for the stock price to plaster over. But for the time being, the stock price is at all-time highs. Elon's looking like a genius. Substantively, this thing is not doing a great job. They deliver more cars, but, you know, margins are under pressure. The China factory, there's an awful lot of opacity surrounding it. I mean, this thing is a really difficult thing to get a look at properly. But I think for now, the bulls fully deserve to be jumping up and down and whooping and wailing with the stock price where it is. Congratulations to them. But this is not over until the company either can turn a profit and be sustainable or disprove any of the allegations that are being made against it by the bear community. And I think we're a long way from that yet. So, score this round if you're judging it to the bulls, but they certainly haven't knocked the bears out yet.
Grant, I'm going to put you on the spot because the first time that I interviewed you about Tesla, it was a fairly new story. I don't think most investors didn't really know a lot about it. But remember something that you said very clearly. You said, okay, look, clearly this guy, Elon Musk, is a genius. The guy's brilliant. But I have some concerns about Tesla, so on and so forth. I kind of bit my tongue at the time because I had a different view. But at this point, what you've learned from the last few years of following this story, do you still think Elon Musk is brilliant and a genius, or do you think he's just maybe the best con man who's ever lived?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, it's a fascinating question, and thanks for reminding me of that. Yeah, look, first of all, it's very unlike you to bite your tongue, so well done for once in your life. But do you know what? I think it's a perfect example of the fact that I, like many others, bought into the narrative. I wasn't paying attention to Tesla, right? I keep reading about this guy who's landing rockets and doing all this crazy stuff and what a genius he is. And you can't help but get caught up in that, right? And I think that's how this thing ultimately fails, because what happened to me has been happening to a lot of other people. The closer you look, the closer you realize he is a charlatan and he is a fraud. And when I put this, I did a documentary together about Tesla, and it was an attempt at making a balanced piece. I said right off the bat, I said, look, I'm a bear. I think this thing's worth zero, but I'm going to talk to some of the bulls and see if we can get out. And obviously, even though I am as circumspect as I can be about this stuff, I still get plenty of hate about being a bear and a hater and all this, what an evil person I am and all that stuff, which is kind of comes with the territory when you do these things. But the one thing I found, the common thread that everybody on the bear side has with Tesla, is incredibly illustrative of the point you were just making. At some point, they weren't really paying attention to Tesla. They didn't really care. They heard about this guy doing amazing things, assumed he was a genius. And then one glorious day, he steps into a world they know really, really well, and he makes some amazing pronouncement about what he's going to do and how he's going to change the world and how incredible it's all going to be. And they all stop and say, well, hang on a second, that's either A, impossible, or B, a flat-out lie. And it's only when you get confronted with that that you start digging in and realize, well, hang on a second. There are some of the websites that have sprung up. There's a great website called elonmusk.today, which lists all the promises he's made and how many days since he made them. And you just scroll through that. It's just amazing to read some of these things that he promised would happen in 3 to 6 weeks. And here we are 3 to 6 years later and they haven't happened. But people kind of give him a pass. But slowly but surely, people are, as I say, finding out that some of this stuff that he's talking about, even though the press kind of drool over it, as soon as you start digging just a little into the realities of it, you find a rabbit hole which takes you only in one direction. And that is, again, towards an emperor who wears no clothes whatsoever. And so, I find the whole story fascinating. But more importantly, as we've talked about earlier in this podcast, in terms of what the fuel protests represent, I think Tesla is important in a similar way to WeWork, in that it wraps up, and I've spoken about this previously many times, it pulls together so many threads of the society that we've built around ourselves. It's all about free money and low cost of capital and malinvestment. It's about the green movement. It's about celebrity culture. It's about central bank policy. It's about captured regulators. It pulls everything that has been either a problem or a component part of this financial ecosystem that we've built over the last decade. It pulls it all into one stock. So I'm very keen to watch how Tesla unravels, because I do believe it will, because I think that will send some very important signals as to how the broader market might unravel.
Grant, I have to wonder if this is all a great big matter of wishful thinking, because when you think about it, nobody's got a better story than Elon Musk in the sense of wouldn't it be great if everything he said was true? I mean, you know, we're not only going to solve all of these problems, we're going to have underground super fast trains, Los Angeles to San Francisco in 45 minutes. We're going to do it in a way which, you know, doesn't produce any emissions whatsoever. We're going to solve global warming, and we're going to have nightclubs on Mars. And it's just going to be great. Nobody's got a better vision that I think maybe helps people to escape from reality. And that really, if you think about it, it's what he does, is to help people escape from reality. When he's confronted with, okay, dude, your business is failing, clearly failing. The evidence is obvious everywhere. What do you have to say to investors? The answer, we're going to introduce not a flamethrower, basically a $600 glorified butane lighter that will take your attention away from the fact that my car company never had a viable business plan, and focus on something that's really cool and fun, and you can pretend that you're kind of like a superhero with this flamethrower thing, and you know, $600, buy one. They were sold out instantly. He's got this talent for somehow just taking the seemingly impossible challenges in terms of being confronted by evidence that the business plan that he's had for Tesla just never made any sense. And hey, who else could possibly, in the environment of being confronted with something as difficult as that, just smile and say, flamethrowers, babe, they're coming. And it worked.
It did. But I think there's two really important points you just brought up there. The first thing you spoke about all these crazy dreams, is absolutely right. Look, people want to dream, right? We want to believe in a better future. We want to believe anything's possible, right? The thing is, along comes Musk, who plays into that and does talk about colonizing Mars and doing all these amazing things. At no point in the last 100 years did you have, again, the confluence events which allowed the technology to supposedly be available to do that, but more importantly, the cost of capital that allows him to incinerate billions of dollars to chase those dreams. You know, at no point in the future when people could have got 5% returns just by sitting in two-year treasuries, are they going to let Musk piss away billions and billions of dollars? It just wouldn't happen. So, you know, it's very important that this is happening now. And that's why this central bank thing is important. It's why it's another big thread that Tesla pulls together. But the other thing you said that really struck me, you said, you know, you said it's obvious his business is failing. And the big question there is, it's obvious to whom? Because anyone with a financial background who understands either how to read a balance sheet or how financial fraud is conducted, yes, it's obvious to them. But to people that have no understanding of finance, who have no idea what a balance sheet looks like, have no idea what accounts receivable is about, the shade that's being thrown at Musk by people who really understand how his company is being built means nothing. And so you can throw as much of this shade as you want, but if you're talking to an audience who, with the best will in the world, even if they wanted to understand it, couldn't, they'd simply fall back on their dreams. And that way, the people throwing the shade become bad guys because, you know, this guy's trying to change the world for the better. Ultimately, I think you're right. It's an obvious basket case. We know where it's going. And when it goes, it's going to be very painful for a lot of people because this guy who's given them something to dream about is going to be proved to be something other than that. And that's going to be a very bitter pill for people to swallow, and it'll disillusion a lot of people. And the next big dreamer / charlatan / fraud is going to have a really hard time getting people's confidence. But that's the way these things work.
Well, and what I fear, Grant, is that Tesla is and Musk are just a proxy for the same phenomenon on a much, much larger scale playing out before our eyes. And it goes back to the civil unrest and the universal basic income and everything else that we've been discussing in this interview. We're going to get to the point where there is an introduction, whether it's Bernie Sanders doing it or Elizabeth Warren or AOC, I don't know. But there's going to eventually be universal basic income, forgiveness of college loans. It's going to be perceived initially as the greatest thing ever. There's going to be a giant celebration. It's going to be just so wonderful that we have leadership now, which is changing the world for the better. And guys like you and me will be, at least temporarily, you know, public enemy number one. We were the naysayers who didn't believe in what was possible that these people brought to us. And at first, it seems completely successful. You and I know, because we've been studying economics for all of our lives, that eventually that results in this perfect storm that leads to a runaway inflation and an inflationary greater depression. But that as you say, that might be obvious to you and me. It's not obvious to most people, and we probably sound like the bad guys in this story. If most people who have no background in investing in economics listening to this interview would think, listen to these two jerks bashing a visionary leader of tomorrow like Elon Musk. What is wrong with these guys? I'm just afraid of what the bigger picture setup is going to be for the economy and what's going to happen when these folks are let down by economic realities sinking in.
Well, look, that's the problem right there. It's reality. And so you can choose to ignore it. You can choose to be upset by it. You can choose to be angry at it and lash out against it. But reality is reality. You know, what we have right now isn't economic or fundamental reality. It's the reality we have to deal with every day. But we all know, at least one would hope we all know, that you cannot just print money and it all works out. We know. But as you said, you know, we know because we've read financial history and we've studied and we understand these forces. But, you know, I'm still struck by some of the conversations I've had over the holiday period with people who aren't involved in this at all. They're very smart, well-educated people who just happen to have their interests in either medicine or science or wherever it may be, just not finance. And when you explain to people what's actually happened over the last decade or so post-crisis, what led to it and what has been done to prevent it and why, people, their first reaction is, I had absolutely no idea. And the second response is they get very angry very quickly about what's happened. And sure, that they might be getting angry very quickly because they're getting the kind of slant on it that you and I are talking about here because it's coming from me. But people aren't paying attention. And that's probably the best thing that the government and the central banks have going for them right now. And long may it continue for their sake. But at some point when you need to pay for groceries and you can't, you do start paying attention. And it's amazing how quickly the scales fall from people's eyes at times like that.
Grant, I will face a mutiny of our listeners if we don't get to gold pretty quickly here, because that's something not only that you're very well known as an expert on, but you were singing the praises of gold. You've been bullish gold for the last several years. And I definitely have to credit you. When we last spoke, I think a year ago on this program, I was saying, look, Grant, there's just a lot of reasons to think that the dollar short squeeze that is gripping the global economy is going to take gold down before it goes up. And you were just very steadfast in saying, look, that's entirely possible, but it doesn't matter, because even if gold is trending down for the purposes that you so eloquently described that you own gold, it doesn't matter. You're basically providing yourself with a degree of separation from the paper financial system. So no matter what happens, you're preserving some of your wealth. The big question I want to hit you with this week is, we know that story from your previous interviews about even when gold was trending down, you still wanted to own it, and we understand why. And for our listeners, if you're new to this and haven't heard that, I recommend that you go back and listen to Grant's prior interviews here on Macro Voices to get that story. But the thing is, Grant, now it looks like gold definitely is trending higher. Is it time to change strategies and to not just be thinking about it as an insurance policy? And if so, how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, look, let's separate the two. A core position in precious metals is an allocation. It's a hedge. It's insurance policy, whatever you want to call it. And I think that that is something that every portfolio should have and adjust up and down depending on the reasons. And as I've said in other podcasts, you know, I think of it, I call it the unsurance policy, in that depending on how unsure you are about the outcome in the markets, that's the percentage of gold you should have. If you think there's a 0% chance of a bad outcome, don't own any gold. If you think there's, you know, it's a coin toss, then perhaps 50% gold is a more sensible allocation. But putting that aside and talking about trading the gold price, which I really try and steer clear of, I mess around every now and again, but it's not, I think there are plenty of things that are easier to trade than gold and silver mining shares. But, you know, if you look over the last year, 2019, I was reading an article yesterday. If you look at the S&P was up 29%, gold was up 19%. So, yes, it underperformed, but if that's your hedge against the S&P falling and your hedge has actually gone up 20%, that's a pretty good performance. But when you look at the ETFs of the mining shares themselves, it's extraordinary what happened. I mean, most of this happened in the back half of the year. You know, the junior silver miners were up 60-odd percent. The Huey Gold Bugs Index, which is a benchmark, was up 50%, almost doubled the S&P. And then all the other gold mining ETFs outpaced the S&P by a considerable amount. And I gave a presentation back in July at our friend Rick Rule's conference talking about what was happening in the gold and silver markets. And I said at that point, I don't talk about the price when I talk about these things. The last time I really did that was December 2015, when I gave a presentation called Nobody Cares, which if anybody wants to watch, it's on YouTube. You'll find it up there somewhere. And that was the last time I really came out and said, look, I think the price is going to start to run now, and I think the gold mining shares are going to have a really decent run. And my timing was pure fluke. I'll be the first to admit that, but we had the next 6 months, we had an extraordinary rally in gold and silver, the metals, and also the mining stocks. And since I did that presentation, it was called Crikey, and I think you can find Crikey on the internet as well. If you search for that, you'll see that presentation. And again, it was the first time in 4 years that I talked about the fact that I think the stars were really aligning for a very strong run in gold and silver miners and the underlying metals, and that people should start to position themselves accordingly. And that's played out. And, we've touched on $1,600, which for many people is an important level. I mean, it really isn't in the scheme of things, but people love these round numbers. But, I think there are so many incredibly constructive charts for precious metals that I think the path of least resistance is up. We will get consolidations, as we always do with this thing. And sometimes the consolidations are a lot more painful than the rallies are joyful. And that's something that if you're going to get into the gold and silver mining complex, you really have to understand just how volatile, how painful these things are, and be very adept at positioning yourselves correctly. But, again, the DXY was basically unchanged last year. So all this talk about the strong dollar and the squeeze, it hasn't materialized. That's not to say it won't. But I think even if it does, there is still a very strong case for being long gold, silver, and particularly if you're chasing leverage, then the mining shares. Right now, they're probably not a sensible time to buy them. I would look for some consolidation, but I think they go higher.
Grant, finally, before we go, I want to touch on things that make you go, your newsletter, which has gotten a huge amount of attention. I think it's coming up on 10 years old now and gets probably better reviews. I don't know how the heck you find time to write it. It's not a 2 or 3 pager every month. It's more like 50 or 60 on a good month. How do you pull this off? Give our listeners who are not familiar with it a sense of what they can expect. And is it possible, if we push a little on you, to get a free offer of some kind, maybe a sample issue?
Yeah, you're shameless, Eric. You know that, right? No, of course. People,
you said I don't bite my tongue, you know.
No, exactly right. Exactly right. Look, by all means, yeah, that I'd be delighted if people want to take a look at it. I'd be delighted to. I mean, look, it's a labor of love. It's something that I've loved doing, and I try and look around the fringes of what's going on and try and find either an interesting angle on a story that's in the mainstream or a story that nobody's really thinking about. And there's a lot of big picture thinking and ideas in there. And just trying to join the dots and really just help people to think about things either in a different way or think about things that perhaps they might not have noticed were happening and try and explain to them how that can affect what is a very, very complicated picture. You know, it's been a lot of fun. I've met some incredible people writing it, and I've shared a lot of great information with people who've been very kind to help me put these things together. So look, I love doing it. It is, as I said, a labor of love. And if anyone wants to check it out, then feel free to let me know.
And how do they reach you in order to do that?
The best way is just send me an email at info@ttmygh.com. And you can check the website out, ttmygh.com.
And of course, your Twitter handle is also @ttymgh. Grant, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it's always great to have Grant back on the show, but I have a question for you. Clearly, you guys both agree that the civil unrest around the globe is a major issue and that it's getting worse, not better, and that there's even more to come. But you didn't really discuss what we should be watching for to tell us how the trend is developing. Can you share some insights with our listeners in that regard?
Patrick, we've got a major barometer signal, if you will, coming up just in the next few weeks. What is absolutely certain to happen is that the Senate trial of the president will close and President Trump will not be removed from office. Now, in case anyone listening is not familiar with the mechanics of this, the reason that I'm so certain of that is simply that, first of all, they don't have the votes if they needed a simple majority to convict the president, but they don't need a simple majority. It would take a 67-vote supermajority of the Senate to convict the president. That is just completely, totally out of the question. The reason that they're pushing this is it's an election year and they want to put the president through the trial and so forth and hopefully affect how voters will make their decisions in November. The point, though, Patrick, is that when this event occurs, there's going to be an announcement. Okay, the president was not removed from office. That is going to frustrate and annoy all of the people who think that he should have been removed from office. The question is, okay, we know that this is not news. Anybody who's been paying attention and understands what's happening here knew to expect the outcome that we're going to get, which is the president will not be removed from office. Does that mean that logic and reason prevail and everyone's reaction is just, yeah, we knew to expect that. There's really no news here. Let's move along. There's nothing to react to. Or do people freak out and start throwing Molotov cocktails and burning down public buildings? It's a question of how ready emotionally the public is to react to this kind of news event. And I think that will be a very telling precursor to the really big question, which is when we get to the election. Just this week, Project Veritas released some more of their undercover videos. Now, clearly, they're picking people with very extreme views to try to highlight just how strong some of those extreme views are. And they're not representative of most people. But the one guy that they interviewed said, you know, if President Trump is reelected, that he and his cohorts would burn down every major city in America. Are there just a couple of kooks that are saying these things? Or is there really going to be, if President Trump is reelected, a major civic uprising that is going to cause all kinds of mayhem and problems around the country? I don't know the answer. I think that those are very, very important things to watch because they'll give us a gauge on how under control or not under control the general public is in terms of their discontentment with the overall situation that exists in government. The first signal will come as soon as we get official confirmation that the president was not removed from office. Now, of course, when that occurs is unknown. The trial starts next week, but how long it takes, whether or not they call witnesses, these are open questions. So at some point in the next several weeks, that should be over. We'll find out the president was not removed, and I'm going to be watching very closely to see what the public reaction is to that. Meanwhile, Patrick, I want to move on to our post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your research roundup email. It says post-game chart book. Patrick, the title slide says Gold Hedge Wrap. Now, that, of course, is the sandwich that's being served for lunch at VRIC this weekend. What are we looking at here on page two?
Before we get to the gold hedge wrap or collar, I wanted to actually just give everyone a quick update on the S&P and the NASDAQ, because last week in the chart book, we drew on the charts with the what I call the measured moves. And like you were referencing earlier, there are DMARC techniques that are already saying that this is very mature. The technique I use of measuring is just an idea of as to what would a natural move in the market be before some reactive correction was to ensue. And so the S&P 500, the upper measured target was 3,300. 300 to about 3375 zone, which we've now officially entered. We obviously have this big gamma wall that Charlie McElligott's talking about right here going into Friday. But by next week, we're going to have a completely new composition of in terms of where the major levels are. So we'll see how that balances out. But the NASDAQ as well is very mature as in to this 9,000 to 9,200 level. One thing I just want to take away is that this feels very eighth and ninth inning. Like, I don't want to already say that a reversal candle is imminent to start a new wave down, but this rally is very long in the tooth and also way overdue for some sort of a reactive correction down. And sometimes the magnitude of the correction on the other side has a direct correlation with the magnitude of the prior rise, and with us seeing a lot of these crazy advances in things like Apple and Tesla, we may have a bigger than average market correction on the other side. It'll be something that we're right now rolling straddles along this upside. It's going to be a lot of fun to call it as we're going here into the next couple weeks.
Now, Patrick, am I correct to assume that the green boxes that we see at the top right corner of page 2 and 3, those are your target ranges where you would expect the top, if there's going to be a top, to occur somewhere within the vertical range of that green box? Is that the idea?
Right. It's not an absolute. Those would be very natural places for the tops to come in. Right. And so it doesn't mean we can't get an overshoot out of that zone. But those are on balance of probabilities. That's the levels that we would expect the S&P to run out of steam and some sort of a correction to ensue on the other side.
Moving on to page 4, we see the GLD ETF charted here. What's going on this chart?
Right. So last week, we brought to everyone's attention that video where I was at the Silver and Gold Summit on that panel discussion with Brent and Grant Williams and Brent Johnson, that was. So one of the things I talked about in that session was the fact that I was very aggressively long gold, and that was back in October, but I was hedged out with a collar, and I was talking about how you can build amazing asymmetry with these collars. And what I figured was that since we sent out that link last week, anyone who watched that video, which is still linked this week into the session, I thought I would take the opportunity to explain how the gold collar works and why that advantage exists in gold, uniquely in gold, and some of these types of markets like gold.
Fantastic. Let's dive in.
So on page 5, first thing that I wanted to point out was the structure, the term structure of gold futures themselves. And while you've talked about oil term structures many times on the show, I wanted to just kind of highlight the fact that in the gold market, the gold futures trade in contango very clearly. There's storage costs and insurance and all of these different things accounted for. And therefore, the future price of gold is always moving higher the farther you go out on the term structure. And this is a big influencer in option pricing, because if you're going 6 months or 1 year out, what's happening is that your forward price of gold is actually higher, and therefore where the point of put call parity actually exists is actually at a higher strike price than where the spot price is trading today. And so when we get to the examples in the next few pages, this is one of the contributors to the fact that there's this opportunity skew in the risk reward proposition. And so what I wanted to move on chart 6 is to show the actual option skew. And in this case, I chose the S&P 500. But even though I'm using the SPY, this is actually a very normal skew for the vast majority of stocks, which is that they have a fat left tail. It's that old adage that the market rises on an escalator but drops in an elevator. And therefore, everyone is looking for that downside tail risk insurance. And therefore, puts are naturally more expensive as you go out of the money. So to illustrate this on the skew, I went and showed that at the time when I snagged this, the SPY was trading at 328.67. And if we went 10% out of the money on a call, it was being priced pretty close to a 10% vol premium. While if you went and 10% out of the money on the put, the vol premium is much closer to 20%. So to loosely translate that, it's almost double the cost of buying an 10% out of the money put, then the premium you would receive as income 10% out of the money on the call. And this type of skew exists very naturally in the markets. And this is why a lot of people that try to build callers on the S&P have unfavorable risk reward propositions in rolling these types of callers on them. But that does not exist in the gold market.
Patrick, before we move on, I know the reason that you're showing this option skew on SPYs is because you want to contrast it to gold on the next page. But I just want to quickly observe here, for people who share my view on the stock market, that it's probably going to continue melting higher, even though it makes no sense, and eventually this is all going to end very badly. But central bank largesse will probably take us higher first. If you hold that view, I've been saying on this program for weeks and weeks now, if you're going to play the upside, do it with options. Well, I just want to point out, those call options are essentially on sale for half off, if you look at what you see here, compared to the cost of puts. So as far as playing the speculative upside, as you say, the caller strategy doesn't work so well, but simply rolling near the money calls every month is a good way to play the upside without having a lot of risk exposure. Let's get back to the subject at hand, though, well, and compare this.
Actually, I want to jump in here and comment on that, actually, Eric, because I want to circle back, because several years ago on this show, we started talking about this and sharing with our listeners this idea of doing ratio call spreads. And Tian Yang from Variant came on many months ago talking about one of the best ways to play the upside of the market here for a melt-up scenario was to do these ratioed call spreads. And one of the reasons why ratio call spreads are effective is because an at-the-money call tends to actually be priced at a much richer premium than the out-of-the-money calls. And therefore, you can actually often even achieve the ability to buy three or four call options out of the money for one at-the-money call to create the ratio. And a lot of that exists because of this skew. So with that, I want to move on, though, and look at the gold skew, which is on page 7. And what we have is a complete reversal and flip. What we see is that for the gold option skew, you actually have a fat right tail, not a fat left tail. And that's rightfully so, because gold is often viewed as an insurance of shit hitting the fan. And so one would assume that gold could actually do relatively well when risk assets are getting punished. And therefore, it has this element where there's a lot of active buying of out-of-the-money call options to create this skew. But this skew massively contributes to our ability to create this gold collar in this asymmetric way, where I can put on the trade and risk a very small amount of money, or at least relatively a small amount of money, compared to the upside potential I have if gold was to go. And so I want to demonstrate this by actually showing this skew and how that plays out. But just to for those of our listeners that aren't looking at the chart book, what you can see here is that, let's say, at 5% out of the money, GLD gold put is actually being priced at near a 10% vol premium, while a 5% out of the money call is actually being priced closer to 14% vol premium. And so you're getting a substantial premium pickup on call selling. And so what I wanted to do on chart 8 is just simply say, well, let's just show what an equal distance 5% out of the money put protection versus a 5% upside covered call would look like going out for the rest of the year. Obviously, we have biases in terms of what duration and things like this, but this is just a good idea for our listeners to capture what that would mean. And so right now, at the time when I snagged this, the GLD was trading at 146.53 for the Spider Gold Shares ETF. And so going 5% lower, roughly the 139 strike, to buy the put to remove all risk of loss below 139 would cost you $2.85, or $285 for every 100 shares of GLD. So subsequently, how much premium or income could I receive selling a covered call for income, let's say 5% higher, or roughly around the $154 strike? And the bid on the covered call is $5.55, not quite double, but a very rich credit income that you're making on a relative basis to the cost of the put. So $2.85 for the cost of the put, $5.55 for the call. Now, in order to create a zero cost caller, you can go even farther out of the money on the strikes and create, you know, 10%+ upside potential on the upside of gold and still do this caller at very close to zero cost. And this is what we love to do at Big Picture Trading, is find ways to lose small and win big and create this asymmetry asymmetry. And a lot of those opportunities exist on gold. And I'm going to be talking a lot about that at the VRIC. And it's something that I do for my members at Big Picture Trading all the time.
Okay, Patrick, just for the benefit of some of our listeners that might not be completely following all of this because it's a little bit complicated, we started with a chart back on page 7, which showed us that if you want to speculate to the upside using options on gold, that is, you want to buy call options, you're going to pay through the nose for those calls. They're priced pretty expensively because there's lots of other people that had the same idea. But what you're showing us here on page 8 is you're basically taking advantage of that higher premium. You're selling a call that's well above the market, and you're using that money to buy a put, which is below the market. But the point is, they're not equally priced options. You get to pocket a couple of dollars there that just helps your trade. So what's the upshot of this? Are we trying to get to the point where we hit that upside target of 154, or are we hoping not to get that high? Where's the break-even point on this trade?
So as an example, it's not always actually either to capture a credit from an income perspective. The goal is actually to be long gold. And now at Big Picture Trading, we've been long the GLD actually for a year plus. And we've been rolling a collar like this. The most recent one, when I was at the Silver and Gold Summit at the time, our members had a position between 135 and 150 on the collar. So when gold, when the GLD rallied up to 140 and 150 along the upside, we were just approaching where the option right was on the upside. Now we've closed that out and repositioned a brand new collar, continuing to participate on the upside of gold. And the real objective is to be long gold very aggressively and highly leveraged, but being able to define that downside risk along the way. You know, our cost base now on the GLD is actually down like at 125, and yet we've now have almost all risk of loss removed. In fact, we're locking in profits that we're guaranteed to make and continued making the upside of gold. And that's why we can afford to be leveraged, is because we're managing the risk along the way.
Okay, so now the picture is getting clearer. So the idea here is you're so excited about gold, you want to be not just a little bit long gold, not the 10% that a lot of people have in a conventional portfolio, but you want to be levered up to a very significant percentage of your net worth long gold. The thing is, you cannot dare to do that unless you're protecting your downside with those protective puts. Those protective puts cost money, and that could interfere with your gains. And what you're saying is, wait a minute, there's a way to essentially pay for those protective puts almost for free by selling a call. And because the implied volatility on those calls is much higher than the puts, there's an asymmetry, there's a skew where in order to get just a little bit below the market with your protection, which protects you from downside risk, you've got quite a bit of profit potential before you start giving something back after the market price exceeds the strike on the call.
That's exactly right, Eric. And those of our listeners that want to see this in action, we just made an adjusting trade on the existing collar. But more importantly, it could be opened as a brand new trade even at these levels. So anyone that wants to see what we're doing can come and check us out at Big Picture Trading.
And finally, on page 10, we've got the information on when exactly you're speaking for people who are attending VRIC. We've also got Grant's speaking schedule as well. But for people who are not attending VRIC, Patrick, the way to get in on all of this and everything else that you do is just to sign up for a free 2-week trial of Big Picture Trading. Now, if they do sign up for that, have you covered some of these strategies with your members? And is there something that they can look at online once they get their free subscription?
Well, we've done a number of complimentary videos that are in the members section, but right now it's just exciting the trades we have on. We think that this is such an important stage in the market cycle. Not only are we rolling straddles on the S&P to discover where the market tops are going to come in, as well, we've put on some initial short trades on both Tesla and Apple. Of course, we're hedged on those, so I want to make sure that that's clear on the disclosure. At the same time, we've got these gold collars going, so lots of exciting things. And if anyone wants to check out what we're doing, make sure you get a complimentary 2-week trial at bigpicturetrading.com.
And when they get that, that gets them signed up where they can watch your daily webinars, which you do 4 days a week. So again, folks, that's bigpicturetrading.com. This episode was made possible by toptradersunplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. And folks, one last time, please don't email us if you want to get in on the 42% discount on Marin Katusa's newsletter that was discussed in last week's show. If you don't have the Research Roundup email, you can find it at macrovoices.com/Katusa or katusaresearch.com/macrovoices. The real way to solve that problem, though, is to go to macrovoices.com and sign up for your free account. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email each week, and then you'll have all of these things right at the click of a mouse ready to go. Patrick, tell them what they're missing in this week's Research Roundup.
In this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we discussed in the post game. There's a great interview with Dr. Ben Eifert called Uncle Vinny's Repo Market, as well as a link to Lacey Hunt's fourth quarter 2019 review and outlook. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.